This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from Abilene Christian University. It is a very special day for the Annex. We are taping the show live at the 2022 American Sociological Association meeting in Los Angeles. Our distinguished guests are Stefan Timmermans, professor of sociology at UCLA. Stefan is the author or co-author of 6 books and many articles across subfields like the sociology of health and illness, the sociology of science and technology, standardization, evidence-based medicine, and inequalities in the U.S. healthcare system. He is senior medical sociology editor for Social Science and Medicine. Ido Tavery is professor of sociology at NYU, director of graduate studies, and editor of sociological theory. His research focuses on the sociology of culture, theory and method in ethnography, the sociology of religion, interaction, phenomenology, pragmatism, temporality, and social theory, and he is the author or co-author of 5 books. We are here today to discuss their 2 co-authored texts, 2014's Abductive Analysis, Theorizing Qualitative Research, and this year's Data Analysis and Qualitative Research, Theorizing with Abductive Analysis, both published by the University of Chicago Press. Stefan and Ido, thanks so much for making the time to come on the Annex.
It's a tremendous pleasure to be here. We are overwhelmed with the tremendous support in the audience.
Thank you very much for having me. That's really nice. Yeah, for having us here.
Excellent. Well, these books are obviously great and meant to be paired together, so I want to take them in the order of publication. The first book unpacks your theory of qualitative research, and the second book is a more hands-on guide to actually conducting abductive analysis, qualitative research. And so I wanted to start with the fact that many sociologists will be familiar with deductive and inductive reasoning. Perhaps as a starting point, how does abductive reasoning differ from these 2 other traditions?
Let me take this. This is Stefan. So induction is sort of more in specifically in sociology put on the map by grounded theory, and it's looking at data and letting a theorization emerge from that. And one of the hallmarks is that you don't really engage with the literature until you get your story down. And then deductive reasoning is working from set of theoretical premises and conducting a qualitative research project within the confines of the theory in order to change, modify, extend the theorization. So abduction is kind of a combination of these 2 kind of approaches, and at the same time, it's also very distinct in the sense that what you're doing is you're looking in your data for a surprise, a surprising finding in context of the existing literature, and then you use that to leverage a new theoretical insight. And from a philosophy of science perspective, neither induction or deduction actually leads to new empirical findings or new theoretical insights. It's mostly abduction that is the most creative aspect of the research process, but then it doesn't stand by itself. It requires further verification and examination in much more inductive and deductive modes. What abduction is really good at is giving that first theoretical jump out of a data analysis.
So one way to think about it, and that's Ido here, but one way to think about it is kind of like a spiral where you have induction, deduction, and abduction all moving together. And it's not that we think that induction or deduction is not important, but what we're asking is, what does it mean to start from the moment of surprise? What does it mean for us to leverage that and to think about our research and to think about the way that we both process the research and also think about theory from this moment of surprise?
Okay, great. One of the things I appreciated about your book is how you contrast abductive analysis with grounded theory and the extended case method. And Stefan, you just said grounded theory as an inductive method doesn't itself get you to new theorizing. So could you unpack how you talk about grounded theory and extended case method relative to abductive analysis with a view of generating theory?
Yeah, let me just answer that question from the perspective of how we actually came up with abductive analysis as an alternative way of analyzing data. So I've been teaching grounded theory for probably like 10, 15 years in various graduate programs at Brandeis University and at UCLA. And I was trained in the grounded theory tradition. My dissertation advisor was Lee Starr, and she was a student of Anselm Strauss. So I feel like I'm the intellectual grandchild of Anselm Strauss. And I'm very fond of the grounded theory tradition. But I just noticed that there's very little innovative new theory coming out of grounded theory, and actually the most creative work is in the work of Anselm Strauss and Barney Glaser themselves, the two founding figures of grounded theory. And so I felt there was a big gap between what researchers said they did, and particularly around using theory throughout the research process, and what they actually wrote in their methods section. And they wrote in their metrics section that they worked inductively with their material, but they didn't come to the literature until the end. And so one of the goals of abductive analysis is to bring the practice and the reality closer together. And it's very difficult to make a theoretical contribution if you're unaware of what's out there in the literature. And so what abductive analysis tries to do is focus on this moment of discovery, on the surprising finding, but it's only surprising in light of the existing literature. Somebody recently wrote on Twitter that abductive analysis is the kind of WTF method. It's like the what the fuck is happening in my research, you know? It's like that moment, like you're looking at your data and you're like, oh my God, where does this go? How does this make sense? This doesn't make any sense in the context of what people have been doing. And then extended case method, we engage less with that because that's not really the tradition I come from. But my understanding of that is that people work with their favorite theory and try to expand and extend their favorite theory. And that seemed to, again, overly limited to the actual practice where you need to be much more nimble and navigating between different theoretical traditions. So from where I'm looking at the world, before abductive analysis, grounded theory was just the overwhelming majority of qualitative researchers said they were doing grounded theory, even though millions of different ways of doing grounded theory traveled under that flag. But still, there is something inherent in grounded theory, specifically with the recommendation to not engage the theory until the end of your research project. That makes it extraordinarily difficult pedagogically and also epistemologically as a researcher to use that to good effect. And again, abductive analysis tries to be much more realistic about what is going to set you up as for success as a qualitative researcher.
One thing that I would add is I think if I'm thinking about grounded theory, my sense is that there's a lot of really great people who do grounded theory, and they're increasingly starting to talk about abduction because they're realizing that if they keep talking about induction, then either they say one thing and do something quite different, which I think happens a lot to all of us, but I think we can actually say what we do. That's a better idea. Or they end up really getting stuck with these typologies and bunches of notes and not quite sure how to move it forward. And I think that's really unfortunate because I think a lot of really great researchers and especially budding researchers are kind of hamstrung by that.
I had a lot of aha moments when I was reading these books, flashbacks from my own qualitative dissertation process and confronting the pile of ethnographic field notes and interview transcripts that I had conducted. And part of me wishes I had these books, let's just say, over a decade ago. But as an interactionist who has engaged with pragmatism in my own work, I am convinced, and from your book and other experiences, that the pragmatic tradition does help us really break through some unhelpful binaries like the discovery justification division and the theory creation versus empirical research. So I'm curious, for those who maybe aren't as familiar with that tradition, how did you both get interested in working with pragmatism in the first place?
So I think we're both interested in pragmatism to begin with. I think we're both interactionists at heart. I mean, Stefan through Alfson Strauss and others, and myself through both my work in Israel before I came to grad school, and then coming to graduate school and working both with Stefan himself and other people such as Jack Katz and the ethnomethodologists that were there at the time. So we both were already interested in pragmatism. We knew less about Peirce, like I think a lot of others, than we knew about Mead. And what happened was that the first piece that we wrote together was a piece about grounded theory and ethnography. And it was a piece about how to do ethnography from a grounded theory perspective. And this handbook of grounded theory came out, and we were reading this handbook, and a couple of European English people, Karen Locke, Jan Strubing, a couple of people were talking about abduction. And we just felt like the world collapsed. There was this aha abductive moment there. And then the more we thought about what do we do with that, the more we realized we need to think with Peirce and about Peirce. And we both did this very, very deep dive into Peirce and realized that we need to not only say, oh, there's also a moment of abduction, but what we really should think about is how to organize the research project from this perspective. And I think one of the things we like about it most is this implosion of what's called the context of discovery and the context of justification. So it's not that we first discover something and that's something that just happens magically through intuition, through our dreams or whatever. As somebody like Karl Popper, this philosopher of science, would say, and then what we really have to focus on is the moment of justification, which is, but that there's a way to set up our research and our reading in a way in which we privilege the way that these are intertwined rather than artificially separating them.
Well, that's actually a really good segue to the second book, Data Analysis and Qualitative Research, because you do get into the details of doing this work that advances theory and sets up research projects so that you can be surprised and then test the insights that you have based on that surprise with more empirical evidence and, of course, your coding and other kinds of strategies to sort of test those preliminary explanations for what you've found, those deviances from existing theory that you found in your data. So let's talk about surprise. Could you share with us a surprising empirical finding from your ethnographic or interview data that led to a theoretical innovation using abductive analysis? It's story time.
Okay, story time. So I'll give an example. Actually, this precedes the abductive analysis writing and discovery process, but this was one that occurred during my PhD research when I was doing research on cardiopulmonary resuscitation techniques. And I was doing an ethnography where I would be paged whenever a resuscitative effort occurred and then rush to the hospital and see how the event took place and, you know, see what the outcome of it was. And based on the impression that you get from reading the literature and based on the impression of what you find in the public media, you know, the survival rates of these resuscitative efforts are minuscule. So out of hospital resuscitative efforts, it's like 1-4%, while in people have looked at TV shows and there it's about 70%. And so you get this very distorted view that if you just pump on the chest and breathe some secondhand air in somebody's mouth, that you're going to keep them alive or bring them back alive. And in fact, that almost never happens. And so this was like an extraordinary puzzling finding for me. It was very surprising that we have this entire infrastructure around resuscitations, but we don't really have any success rate. So we have built this up as life-saving technology, but we're not saving any lives. And so that then led me to think about, so if we're not saving lives, what are we doing instead? And so, I mean, I'm going to cut short like the actual theoretical innovation, but the argument that I'm making is that actually what CPR does, it saves death. It saves sudden death in the sense that if you didn't have CPR, people would just collapse on the floor and die. And now we have this ritualistic set of movements. We bring these people to the emergency department. We provide them with what we believe is the best care possible. And so it helps to ease some of the relatives left behind into accepting that sudden death happened. And it's sort of what we're actually doing is we're creating a transition ritual via resuscitative efforts. And so I theorize this more from a perspective of this is actually about death and dying. This is not really about a life-saving kind of technology. It's more about how do we come to terms with the finitude of life. And so then it brought me into like, how is that then stratified? And for whom does that work? Under which kind of conditions does that work? And that's where more of the sociological theorization was. But the surprise was really the realization that CPR almost never works in the context of all the discourse around it.
For me, I think, again, like Stefan, I think any research project that you do, once you're attuned to surprises, this is the stuff you talk about in the evening when you're talking to people about what you do. This is what you tell your colleagues when you're meeting for beer during a conference. To give one example, when I was doing my PhD and we were writing abductive analysis at the same time, or writing the paper that led to the book, I was doing an ethnography of an Orthodox Jewish community. And in order to be part of the community, I was walking around with a yarmulke most of the time. And, you know, I was dressed nicely, more nicely than I am now, with a jacket and didn't grow a beard, but I looked Orthodox. And then one day I was walking with a Hasidic friend as we are just talking about gun control, actually, and then suddenly a car goes by. It was during Halloween. Somebody pulled down their masks, shouted Jews, and gave us the finger. And for me, this was an incredibly strange moment. I come from Israel, where, you know, I'm Ashkenazi and Jewish. It's basically being WASP in Israel, and I've never experienced anti-Semitism, and suddenly experienced anti-Semitism, and I was completely shocked. I couldn't even hear what they were saying. I was like, did he say Jews? Did he say you? What did he say? And my friend just looked at me like, you know, what are you making a big deal? Weren't you ever called a kike before? And I was like, wait, that happens? I said, oh yeah, all the time. And it didn't happen all the time, but I started talking to people and I realized it does happen regularly. They didn't even talk about it. So I was really, really stunned both by this moment, but also by the difference between how I acted towards it and how my friend acted towards it. And it's not like we were busy being Jewish. We were talking about our Jewishness and... No, we're talking about gun control. If anything, I was like some bleeding heart liberal and he was a libertarian Republican. And this was a really interesting moment for me to think about how people are brought into being in the streets in everyday life. And it became one of these points where once I saw it there, I saw it everywhere. And my entire dissertation and later my book, Common, really became an account of the ways in which we are made to be who we are in everyday life through all these different micro practices. So it was incredibly important, this moment of surprise, even though it was a very naive surprise in a sense.
Your story here, Ido, makes me think of the practice of research that you talk about in this second book, the index case, and the importance of identifying an exemplary case that captures some important variation that you're trying to theorize in the text. So maybe one of you could just tell us more about what an index case is, and then how you might find an index case, or what to look for when you're thinking, hey, maybe this is an index case that I can use to think about variation in my research.
So we talk about the index case in the context of how to code qualitative data. And of course, coding is a very important practice that has been introduced by grounded theory and that has been traversed the boundaries of grounded theory and has been incorporated in lots of different ways of doing qualitative data analysis. And in the book, we make the case for a form of open coding and then for a case of focused coding. And focused coding is when you actually already have a pretty good sense of what the story could be in the data. I mean, I've been doing research about this for a long time, so you're not really a novice anymore. And you have a hunch of what kind of trace you're going to follow, which is different from open coding, where you sort of like see what is this data really good for. And so an index case then is kind of like one of the instances. It can be an event, it can be a situation, it can be an interaction, the way that Ido just talked about, that really captures all the elements or most of the elements for theorizing, and that you sort of put in the center of your analysis, and you use that as your reference point under which you're going to make comparisons with the other data pieces. So you put a database together from all kinds of similar or related events, and then you put one in the middle and say that is really that typifies the phenomenon that I'm interested in. But of course, you can be wrong about this. So the index case is not like something that is endowed from the beginning and stays there. It can be that through your analysis, you decide, well, that doesn't really pan out. But the process of figuring out through this constant comparison whether the index case is theoretically relevant or not is itself generative of theorizing. So it's like this is the instance where the surprise is the strongest, and that sort of seems to propel forward the analysis. But then it's possible that the outcome of this is that you find a new index case, or another outcome is that you just continue working with it and deepen it and enrich it based on the variation you find in your research.
Yeah, so I just want to add that one thing that is really incredibly important, and I think that's what makes sociological research what it is, but any research what it is that we work through the variation. And then the question, if you're thinking about working through variation as what we really do as researchers, then the question is, well, variation of what towards what, right? And an index case is a way for you to crystallize a point that the other points are going to refer to in different ways. And there's different ways, I think, of doing index cases. I think Stefan and I, even though we work a lot together, we actually do index cases a little bit differently in our research. You can think about the index case as something that's kind of in the middle, the kind of median case or average, you know, this case where that encapsulates a kind of ideal type of what it is you're doing. But you can also think about the index case as a very strange case, but that highlights something that's theoretically incredibly important. So there's different ways of working, and we don't want to even tell students and researchers that there's only one way of doing it. But I think having an index case and thinking about it very carefully and very explicitly becomes incredibly important.
Thanks for sharing on the index, because I thought it was a really important aspect of the text. Okay, which one of you is the funny one? This book has a fun tone. There are some really funny passages and footnotes. I laughed out loud more than once. In some ways, its style reminded me of my experience of doing ethnography among patients and clinicians. Often these folks are very serious, but sometimes exceptionally funny. Things happen that you just would not expect, and people make hilarious jokes. So was it important for you to show your own sense of humor in the book? Or alternatively, what work do you hope this humor does for the text and for the reader?
So let me just share a story with you. I mean, I'm not going to answer directly who is the funny of us, but, you know, it's pretty obvious. So let me tell you a story. So when we were discussing the first book with the publisher at Chicago, I made a very, very strong plea for a different kind of cover. And for those of you who haven't seen the cover, it's basically some kind of psychedelic yellow, orange kind of flowing from one tone into the other. What I really, really wanted was a group of aliens bowing over a autopsy table where a body was laying, and the body had been abducted, and now they were analyzing the entrails of the person. And I found even a drawing of that, but somebody who remains unnamed, but could have been my co-author, sort of nixed that idea.
Bummer.
Very, very strongly.
No, the darker humor is Stefan. This is definitely. The moments of lighter humor, maybe.
I mean, it's also true that sometimes I think something is really funny, and then Ido sort of says, you know, if you read it once, maybe it is funny, but if it stays there, it's going to live on forever. So we keep each other in check a little bit. But when you try to tell a story and there's humor in there, maybe people will remember the humor part and then carry forward the idea with it. And so we explain abductive analysis in the second book with a cooking metaphor, and I think that hopefully will really bring down the differences between induction, deduction, and abduction. So it's also sort of a little bit of trying to grab people's attention. And, you know, methods book can be extraordinarily dry, so if we can put at least a little bit of humor in it, why not?
I also think before we go, I mean, I think seriously.
See, I think the answer of the question is already answered here.
I think humor and theorizing have a lot in common. I think they're both trying to grapple with the reality from different points of view at the same time. And I think thinking that your field is funny or understanding the jokes in your field, you know, Goffman has this thing about, you know, you're in the field when you find the other members of your field attractive. And I think we both always found that to be a very low bar. And I think you really understand a field when you start laughing at the jokes. And I think that's the same for writing, that you start understanding method when you start seeing where it's actually funny.
Yeah, and actually in the second book we have this entire thing about Mary Douglas and jokes and about how to, you know, realizing that you're really inside because you understand the jokes. And that, I can tell you honestly, that was completely Ido's contribution to that part of the book. I mean, this is the kind of book also where we, one of us drafts, the other one rewrites it, and it goes back. I mean, we pass every chapter back and forth multiple times to the point where it's difficult to see where one sentence begins with one person and one sentence ends with the other person.
You're right, the humor works in this way, right? You know, a joke with an obvious punchline is not a joke.
Yeah,
it's a sentence. So there are some good parallels there. I have to ask about the baby.
Okay.
So for those of you who do not have a copy of the second book, there is a picture of a very cute white infant just inside the front cover, first couple of pages. And the baby has a look of surprise. Who put the baby in the book?
Yeah, we just forgot it inside. We never even discussed between ourselves if we're going to have it or not. And then when we got the proofs, we suddenly saw the baby and we looked at each other and we're like, oh yeah.
Okay, so we had a working title for this book. The working title was Surprise, Abductive Analysis in Action. And we really, really thought that captures the book completely. However, if you type surprise in Google Images, the baby comes up. And so that's how the baby was there. So we used to have that baby in front of us on the first page whenever we opened this document. So we had this surprise. And it was a good reminder for us that, you know, we need to make sure that we always come back to this theme of surprise. But the reason why we don't have that as the final title was that if you type surprise in Amazon, and Amazon is of course like a major bookseller even for methods books, you get children's books. So the press really pushed us to come up with a title that would be more in line with qualitative data analysis books. But they felt kind of bad about it, that they had to take away our really lovely surprise title. So they let us keep the baby, but the title changed. I'm actually not really sure that we insisted on that title being, that baby being in there, but they sort of felt like that baby needs to still be in there.
I should just say, there's no context to this baby at all. There's no other text on this page whatsoever. No. I opened it up for the first time. There's a shocked baby in the front.
Yeah, and apparently it was not protected with, copyright, so they loved it. So, so this is like one of those little wrinkles in the publishing part where you think it's just all rational and very efficient and effective. But in fact, there is also a sense of humor in the publishing world where people are like, you know, we can do something funny too.
Yeah, pro tip for those who are publishing books, get Creative Commons photos, you know, save your publisher some cash and yourself some headaches for having to buy rights. We're all about helping people out here. I get the sense that you're frustrated by qualitative work that ends with a descriptive typology. So why do you think so much qualitative research ends there? In other words, why the lack of theorizing with qualitative methods?
We can both answer this, but so I'm editor, as you mentioned at the beginning, of the senior medical sociology editor of the journal Social Science and Medicine, and I get about 1,000 papers a year as editor of this journal, and almost every week I get a paper that just takes 20, 30 interviews, and the abstract says, here are three themes in these interviews. There's no contextualization, there's no argumentation. I just found three themes, and I would say that some of that has been justified by a very impoverished understanding of what grounded theory does, and it's sort of grounded theory, some understandings of grounded theory has licensed this kind of paper writing, and then they don't fare well in peer review. They don't fare well even with me in terms of sending them out for peer review. So this is where a typology is a good first step in the analysis, but then you need to think about how do these themes work together, what are the consequences, how do they originate, how do they interplay, what is the temporal sequence in there. So you have to do much more work. It's like a good first step, but it's not a final product of a qualitative data project.
So to add to that, if you're thinking about what is a piece of writing, a piece of academic writing, for me, most importantly, writing is entering into a intellectual and disciplinary conversation. When you're in a conversation, you just don't go just throw out a few words and go away. You could, but that would be a really bad conversational skills. You add into a conversation that goes on, you take what came before you into account, you try to push the conversation forward. And that's what we do as intellectuals, that's what we do as sociologists. We have to do that. And I think people that just take it and create a typology without even telling you, well, why this typology? What does this typology tell us about other things? What's the process that created this typology? It becomes, in some ways, a kind of empty conversational terms where you're just shouting something and going away. And it doesn't work neither in peer review, but it also just doesn't work as an intellectual contribution. So I think we feel very strongly about that.
I'm glad you mentioned the idea of what other potential fields or ideas or what other potential applications there are for the idea that you develop. Because one of the things that comes across in the book to me is that as you're conducting your research, as you're writing up your field notes, as you're beginning your, as you're analyzing those notes and coding them, you may find that you need to engage another literature. Mm-hmm. Right. In order to push those ideas forward, or you notice some synergies or some parallels between what you're seeing in one field site and then what another subfield of sociology has to say. It's really helpful for researchers to keep their eyes open and to keep engaging with reading outside of their narrow subdisciplinary focus in order to draw those connections and bring literatures together, which is one place where you can do some interesting theoretical work.
Just on that, we talked a lot about theorizing in this new book, even though it's a how-to-do-it book. I think there's a question of how to theorize, and we use this metaphor that I think a lot about when I think about what theory is, that a theory is a mode of traveling, right? It's a mode of your ideas traveling to other places, to other subfields, to other problems, to other questions. And we kind of developed this theory of map and compass. And actually really, I think by chance, we sent it and Mario Small said, you know that I wrote about maps and compasses earlier? And we're like, oh my God, that was after the book was out. So shout out to Mario. But this idea that if you're thinking about traveling, you have to think about from where and to where. Right? I mean, to be interesting, like for theory to be interesting, interesting is not a thing in itself. It's a property of something in it's a relational property. And then you have to think in relation to what and towards what. And I think this is, again, part of what makes a conversation so important.
Well, one other piece of good advice and good practice in the book is testing one's ideas within a community of inquiry. So what advice might you have for early career researchers or perhaps those who are in small departments on this, developing a community of inquiry and ensuring that you have an adequate ground to test your abductive insights?
Well, I think there's no shortcut around exposing your ideas to other people's opinions. And of course, you need to be pretty careful about who you ask to review your work, because you don't want anybody who just is going to appropriate it in a sense that this is how they would want to have done the research project. So you want to expose your ideas with somebody who can appreciate it for what you are trying to achieve. But I think if you want to participate in this broader conversation, ultimately what you want to have happen is that your work gets cited, that your work becomes a passage point for other people to travel through if they want to reach their own destination. And that's never going to happen if you don't at least test it out in advance by asking for other people's input. And, you know, so this is actually not just an issue for junior faculty members. Sometimes very senior faculty members, they feel like, you know, I don't have to worry about peer review because I have so much experience writing whatever I've written. I don't really need to do this anymore. And that doesn't always work out. I mean, I've reviewed books, I've seen manuscripts where there's some obvious issues that if they were not on your vision field, that you probably would have ignored, but that other people would have pointed out, and the argument would have been much stronger for all the effort you put in it, to it would have benefited from some other eyes on it. So it's one of those issues. It's sort of almost similar to like thinking about on the level of importance as who would you want to interview, what kind of literature do you want to read. It's on the same level of importance that you have an other set of eyes on it, and that you engage in a debate or engage in feedback loop with other people, and you create a writing group or you create a conference like ASA, you just discuss and share some drafts with somebody else. So you just need to do it. I mean, it is absolutely important, because you don't want to write it just for the fun of it, or you want it to eventually to travel. I mean, I have a very, probably more than Ido, more of an instrumentalist perspective, that it's not just that it can be interesting or theoretically puzzling. It needs to have something that people can use, that people can appropriate, which is actually also the idea behind abductive analysis, because Peirce wrote about abduction, but he's not a qualitative methodologist. We had to do a lot of translation work to take these very broad philosophy of science ideas and make them work within sociology, and that is, as you mentioned at the beginning, is within a dialogue of what grounded theory has done and some of the excesses there, and what the extended case method have done, and sort of like finding a middle spot that is consistent within that broader logic. There needs to be an audience, and you do this kind of work because you want to have an impact on an audience.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I agree with everything that Stefan said, but I do think that, you know, students and often faculty at smaller colleges, it's more challenging, right? I mean, they have less people going through their universities. Sometimes the training is different. Sometimes they're not encouraged even to send their work to big journals. I mean, I remember that one of the things when I was a grad student, and I was talking with Anne Swidler actually about graduate school, and she said that, you know what, the biggest difference between students in what are called elite departments and in small departments is that some of the students in the smaller departments don't even think that they can send their work to certain places. I remember it. I was shocked by that in the beginning. But what is your horizon of where you're aiming is really important. And I think one of the things to do if you're in a smaller place, or in a place where you don't feel you're getting this kind of mentorship, I think, is going to small conferences. ASA is, I like ASA, you get to see your friends. But ASA can be very impersonal, very big, very intimidating. I think smaller conferences can be really, really wonderful. And also, you know, the other thing, it takes a little bit of chutzpah, but to send an email and say, like, you know, I've read your work, I have this thing I want to discuss with you, to a faculty that is going to be somewhere, I think is incredibly important. I know that for myself, I would never say no if somebody would actually want to talk to me about ideas and not kind of want to network. That, you know, this is what we do our work for, you know, and I think a lot of people feel that way. So I would really encourage students and faculty to go to these smaller conferences, to send emails ahead of time and set time for coffee. There's people that I met in conferences that way that remained people that I talked to for years to come.
So if you want to do that, it's ido.tavori@nyu.edu. Send all your requests and your requests for feedback that way.
I knew it. Well, I will say, in the book, there are some great passages that take us inside the open coding process that you take your students through, Stefan. And so there are examples in there of students who are reading others' field notes and then on the board talking about what's going on, the who, what, when, where, how, the basic kinds of questions that set us up for insights and surprises. And so if you've ever wondered, as I have, what a graduate seminar at UCLA in ethnography looks like, at least a little bit, this is your chance to kind of get a sense of what that's like. I mean, for me, I also consider myself an intellectual grandchild of Anselm Strauss. In those books, there's always that, and we were coding together at my house or wherever it was. And you just want to say, like, I want to be a fly on that wall. You know, what was it like when Anselm is doing this work in the hospital, thinking about technology and thinking about coordination work? And the same thing with Lee Starr, of course.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of actually sort of passed down in the tradition. And it's one of the really good things about grounded theory is to work as a group on somebody's data. So Anselm did that with his students, Lee Starr, Adela Clark, John Fujimura have done that with their students. And now I'm doing it. and Ido is doing it at NYU. So at UCLA, when we teach ethnography and qualitative research methods, we have one quarter where we devote to data gathering, and then one quarter that we devote to data analysis, and they're consecutive quarters. And really the pedagogy of that second part of the class is that we have students share their field notes with the class in advance, and then they have to sit back. So the person who wrote the field notes is not allowed to say anything, because they have, sometimes have a tendency to say, oh, what really happened was X, Y, and Z. And so they're sort of voiding the creative process. And then the other students work with and ask questions and look at what's happening in the data, and they start to conceptualize and to think through about what is going on in the data. And it's just extraordinarily generative, especially for the student who's supposed to be quiet, because the richness of the data is exposed within those kind of seminars, and students learn from each other when the stakes are really low. So I'm a very big fan of that kind of an approach. And I always encourage students after the class ends, keep a writing or data analysis group going and sort of exchange this kind of notes. So this is something that I think pedagogically, in terms of whatever your methodological approach is in terms of qualitative data analysis, it's extraordinarily positive and constructive way of doing data analysis.
We're running short on our time. I want to be respectful of that. But is there anything else you all want to say about this book? The process of writing it together, anything that's important that we left out or you'd just like to leave folks with?
One thing that I think we are happy about, we didn't set up to write two books. We thought we were going to write one book, and we were pretty happy with that book. But then we started getting responses saying, this is nice, but I don't know what to do with it. And I think it really was this moment for us for sitting down. And I remember Stefan was like, well, we need to write another book. And we need to think really carefully about how we work and not gloss it over. And if we're saying that we're doing it, then how do we do it? And, you know, we're giving the best that we can in terms of how we approach research and how we think about research. We don't think that's the only way of thinking about research, but we think that it might be helpful for people as they're trying to work through their project and to work through what their place is in this kind of ongoing intellectual conversation.
Yeah, I want to just reinforce that message from Ido. Like, from a pragmatist perspective, what really is important is that it works for people. So this is not an ideological book in terms of, like, if you don't do it this way, that your project is going to be a failure. It's like a book that gives you a whole set of tools and ways of thinking and ways of approaching research to try to set you up for success in data analysis. In qualitative research, it's very easy to do a bunch of interviews and get a whole pile of transcripts together. The difficulty comes into analyzing the data. And what this book is trying to do is try to give you some self-confidence, some tricks of the trade, some vision about how the different parts hang together in order to set you up for success. That's really the only mission. And if it works, the better. If you want to modify some of it, that's the way these things always go. So we're sending it in the world, and hopefully the book will do a lot of good in terms of giving people the skills to pull off a qualitative data analysis.
Well, Stefan and Ido, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on The Annex.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great to be here.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison, now at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Thanks to my guests, Dr. Stefan Timmermans and Dr. Ido Tavery. Stefan is at UCLA and Ido is at NYU. Thanks also to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab, to Lena Orsa for the music, and to our producers. We'll see you next time.